The views presented in this program may not reflect the views of the University of Connecticut, WHUS Radio, or the staff of the station. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. You're listening to WHUS Stores. When I say the word execution, it conjures up an image of a plague doctor or a grim reaper, long flowing black coats that stir mysteriously in the wind, and an ominous bird skull. These archaic fantasies overshadow the hearts and souls of the staff and officers that oversee executions in America today. As images go, these grossly oversimplify the process. I mean, these are people we're talking about. Whether it be lethal injection or electric chair, it's not done by bureaucratic suits or a Halloween-esque scythe-wielding figure. These are humans involved in the process. We have these natural tendencies to empathize with people in front of us, the innate capacity to love and laugh and care. The execution chamber looks like the last place on Earth where empathy could exist, but that isn't true at all. The guard that walks the inmate down to the gurney, the spiritual advisor helping these people, these are people too. When it comes to capital punishment, we focus on the inmate and the victims and the families. This is totally justified. I too think that the story of the crime should revolve around those who've been hurt, but we shouldn't forget about those behind the curtain. Can empathy coexist with these people's duties, or does it have to be shunned into a concrete box? Death Row chaplain Carol Pickett said in his book, There Will Be No Stay, that the death penalty creates another set of victims. My name is Jonathan, and welcome to The Edge of Empathy, where we take a look at communities and stories that most would find hard to empathize with. In our first series, we're going to take a look at executions and who the second set of victims are. To start my journey, I sought out information about who is allowed to witness the execution. Besides the families of the inmates and the victims, there are a couple that the government allows. Among those are journalists, the prison staff tasked with carrying out and overseeing the execution like wardens, and a spiritual advisor. Out of pure interest and easier accessibility, I decided to search for journalists.
Yeah, Joseph Brown. I'm the editor of the Huntsville Item in Huntsville, Texas. Been in journalism for coming on about 13 years now. Covered every type of community under the moon, from small communities to metros. Huntsville, now where I'm at, it's a kind of mid-sized community, about 45,000 to 50,000. And of course, we're home to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. So very unique in that aspect.
That was Joseph Brown with the Huntsville Item. The small local newspaper is the only media organization besides the Associated Press allowed in the execution chamber in Texas. In every other state, this appears to be the case, with the Associated Press in conjunction with the smaller newspaper in the region being the only newspapers allowed to cover the execution.
I've covered executions every one since about middle of 2018. So I've done the past 17 in the state of Texas, or technically 18 up until last week, a couple weeks ago. But so I've covered 17 in person.
Huntsville houses one of the most used execution chambers in the United States, having executed 569 people since the reinstatement of capital punishment in 1976. To compare, the second most prolific state in terms of executions is Virginia, 113. So it makes sense as to why Joseph is so acquainted with them. The big question here is, why journalists? Why do people like Joseph need to be present at executions?
It's totally different from like covering a crime story. Our job, basically, in short, is to ensure everything goes right. And then the biggest tragedy of that issue is so much is not recorded by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Just as an example, if there's a botch, only way it's getting out is media reports. If the offender says something after the process begins, which happens all the time, that's not recorded. Anytime you see this publicly recorded last statements, it's from the beginning they start talking until they'll say, I'm ready, and then they stop. So if the offender starts saying it's burning, any nuances like that that are used in court many, many, many times, it's journalists like myself and the Associated Press, we're the only ones that are there to really report on those issues. Mm-hmm. So, and that's really what it comes down to. That process is more of a accountability and being sure that there is public oversight of, frankly, the gravest punishment society bears and issues.
Joseph makes a really good point. In an age where fake news runs rampant, we need to make sure that we, the readers, can sift through the sand and figure out right from wrong when it comes to government reports. Approval rates of the government, which are low, makes this quest harder. Gallup polled Americans on the topic in 2019 and found that only 12% would rate Congress's ethics and honesty as high. That's why transparency on such a serious topic is important. When the government can legislatively end a person's life, journalists like Joseph need to make sure to get every detail right. On another note, Brown referenced an incident in Huntsville that occurred where an execution took place without any media witnesses. An Associated Press article provides details on the matter, saying that the Texas Department of Justice failed to notify reporters about the execution of Quinton Jones on May 19, 2021, and because of that, there were no media witnesses present. The absence of journalists in this case means that the public can only rely on government reports. And even this is problematic because reports from the media and the government can differ in ever so specific ways. Even the way that the inmates' last breaths are described are different. Another Associated Press article detailed how 13 execution reports called gurneys beds and last breaths snores. There was an execution in September 22nd of a man named William LaCroix. According to the AP, his stomach heaved uncontrollably for at least a minute. The article quoted the interim warden, Eric Williams. During the entirety of the execution, LaCroix did not appear to be in any sort of distress, discomfort, or pain. A short time after he took a deep breath and snored, it appeared to me that LaCroix was in a deep, comfortable sleep. The fact of the matter is, you have the government sanitizing the image of a person dying, almost like they're going to sleep in their jammies. This is why we need journalists. To document every little moment and to humanize what would otherwise be a closed curtain occasion. So, transparency is important. The truth allows us to see what happens beyond the prison walls and to peek into the inner mechanisms of the execution process. To follow that train of thought, I want it to be a little less nebulous. Journalists do have a duty to hold the government accountable, after all, but what physically goes on in that pursuit? I asked a reporter named Danielle Ferguson for help on that question.
So my name is Danielle Ferguson. I'm a reporter based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I've been in journalism professionally for a little over 5 years. No, 6 years. Wow, I'm older. I graduated from Iowa State University in 2016 with a degree in journalism, mass communications and sociology. I worked for my college newspaper. I was the editor-in-chief of the Iowa State Daily. That was a fun, crazy job. And after college, I came back to Sioux Falls and spent 5 years reporting first breaking news, crimes, cops, and then moved up to courts, law and order, criminal justice issues, social justice issues. And then within the last few months, I started working for a nonprofit news organization called South Dakota News Watch, where I get to write about statewide issues. It's been a fun learning experience.
One of the issues that Ferguson gets to write about are executions. There's actually a procedure for how media witnesses are chosen. The Department of Corrections reaches out to a specific news organization and basically says,
you're invited. I don't even know if that's the right word, but you're asked to come as a member of the media in the town in which it occurred. You know, we are required to have that presence in the execution room. And I remember getting that letter and thinking, oh man, I mean, my editors offered, you know, if you don't want to do it, you can ask someone else. But no one else in the room had witnessed one. The other reporter who had witnessed the other one had left at that time. So I didn't really have anyone to even, you know, kick it to, as no one else would have done it either. But some of the other reporters had said, you know, if you don't want to do it, I can do it. So I know I had an out if I wanted it. But I don't know, I thought, what, you know, journalistically, it's weird. You know, journalists are weird people. We're very interesting. I think it's interesting. As a journalist, I was like, this is a rare opportunity. You know, what a, when else am I going to, you know, but as a person, I was like, ugh, no, you know, but I don't know. I thought, well, this is part of my job. I'm the criminal justice reporter. I should do this.
After this, the state confirms the presence of media witnesses at the execution, and it goes in as a little event on your Google Calendar page.
I didn't know how to feel about it. I was like both nervous, but also like, this is a huge responsibility and not many people get to do this, but also I'm terrified. I don't know. He was scheduled to be executed at 1:30 PM on a Monday. I'm pretty sure that South Dakota mostly did theirs on Monday afternoons. And they schedule it in a way where it's like, where the other inmates are all in their cells at a time. And in a way that it doesn't get a lot of like public attention. I mean, it's going to get attention from the media, obviously. And there were some protesters, but they figured if it's on a Saturday, you know, you're going to have even more protesters out there. So I'm thinking that's what went into their decision. But he didn't actually get executed until 7:30 PM or 8 that night.
Oddly, a lot of states actually schedule a lot of executions at 12:01 AM. A Slate article on the subject says this because death warranties only last 24 hours. If the death warranty expires, then the state basically has to repetition for a new one. Another journalist, Scott Kimbler, and we'll come back to him, says that journalists there are transported by bus with the rest of the witnesses. Me, I really can't imagine a bunch of people cramming to a Greyhound with their final destination, being the execution chamber. Jeffrey Collins, a reporter from the Associated Press based in South Carolina, further elaborates on the process.
They walk you across to the prison administration building, the three witnesses, media witnesses. You get searched. They because you can't have any cameras. All you can have basically is a pen and a piece of paper. They have you leave your car keys and everything else in the other room. So, you know, they search you, make sure you don't have anything but the pen and paper. Then you just sit and wait, and you wait. And then eventually they're a 15 passenger van pulls up. You walk down some steps through what's considered the gate. In other words, like when you're into the actual security of the prison, you get in that van and they drive you. It's about a 3 or 4 or 5 minute drive back to the far back of the prison, maybe not all the way back, but close. And then you get out and there's a building and it's probably the size of maybe a small house. I mean, it's not very big. They bring you in, they sit you down. They have these chairs that are spaced out, and you're sitting kind of almost on a little platform. You're up a little, just a very small platform, not very tall. There's a window with bars in front of you, and there's a curtain across it.
It was, so I was 24 at the time, 24. I think I had just turned 24. And it was me and retired correctional officers and then two other media witnesses who are probably 25 years older than me. And we were in a room in the penitentiary, just waiting to be taken to the chamber for that entire time. We couldn't have our phones. I didn't have a notebook. I was sitting there with a bunch of like institutional knowledge of the prison. And they were talking about all these stories in the prison and I couldn't write any of it down. I was like, dang it. This is a gold mine of story ideas. And I couldn't write it down.
Do they not allow pen and paper?
No, they had pen and paper waiting for us in the witness room.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I was like,
they almost didn't let me bring in a hair tie. You know, I had long hair. They we went through the scanners. They didn't want me to bring in a hair tie or like a bobby pin for my.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Dangerous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you kind of sat there for that. Must have been nerve-wracking. You're like, this was supposed to, like, I thought this would have been like a, you know, like a quick occasion, if nonetheless unpleasant.
Well, yeah. And I was so nervous. I mean, I didn't sleep that Sunday night. I was so nervous. I had been, you know, that up until the whole week before during my work hours, I was like researching, writing previews and doing all this. So I was keeping busy. But the night before, it was like the ultimate Sunday scaries. I mean, I didn't sleep. And we had to be there a few hours before. We had to be there by like 9:30 or something like that as witnesses. But then we didn't have a TV or anything. We didn't know what was going on. So we're just sitting there waiting. And I was sitting there stewing in all of the details of everything I'd heard because I'd you know, been reporting on this issue for a couple of years. I talked to all the people involved, and yeah, and you think about, I mean, I was thinking about like the family of the victim, like they're sitting there waiting. And I was thinking about everything, you know, as a journalist, you're trained to think about all sides of everything. I was thinking about, you know, is Brigitte going to get another last meal, you know, or what happens if they stay the execution? Do we just leave? Or do we, I mean, I don't know. It was weird. My nerves eventually wore off a little bit, but then once they came in the room and got us to go, my heart started beating pretty quick again.
Coming up next on The Edge of Empathy.
You know, as a journalist, you're trained to think about all sides of everything. I was thinking
about, I remember Richard Johnson turning his head.
They start gasping.
One of the family members started beating on the protective base, the rug out.
Okay, just to recount, journalists are the doorway to the darkest part of the legal system, the death penalty and the execution process. They hold the higher powers that be accountable. As Ferguson said,
you know, as a journalist, you're trained to think about all sides of everything. I was thinking about, is Brigitte going to get another last meal?
Now, the only side we haven't explored is the interior one.
The room that you're sitting in, viewing the chamber, it's like five or six church pews all lined up. So they're about 20 feet long. They just take up the width of the room. And so you're in there. And it's almost exactly like one side of a church. And when you're in that room, which is climate controlled, generally very cold.
That was Scott Kimbler. He works for iHeartMedia in Atlanta and has been covering executions in Georgia for the past couple of years.
You have to be quiet. I mean, you have to write quietly. Don't clear your throat. Because what you have is often family members of the victim and of the person convicted of doing what they're there to have done, you know? So these are people you don't emotionally want to set off at that time. You don't want to give them a lot of things to react off of, like, things like that, because that'll just feed into whatever they're feeling.
Through his and Ferguson's words, the execution chamber becomes this chilly, distant place from the average person. And now, it's time for the execution. The medical staff ready the IV and the appropriate amount of each drug to be drawn into the inmate's arm. A video by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution explains how it's done. The first is pentobarbital, an anesthetic to put the inmate to sleep. The second is panchronium bromide, usually used as a paralytic. However, in a lethal enough dose, it can stop the lungs. The third is potassium chloride, and this drug stops the heart. The inmate has a chance to say their last words before the drugs are inserted. A Fox News article provides a range of quotes from an apology like, "I want to say that I'm sorry for my crimes. I wanted to say that to the families that were victimized." To a joke, "That'll be $5. Take care." Journalists will usually record these last words. Something special happened in Ferguson's case, though.
What's really struck me in that moment was, so I never heard his voice. You know, and up until that point, it was this man we're talking about who's not here, you know. And then as soon as I saw him strapped to a table, but when I heard him speak, it was like you're a person.
In that moment, Ferguson hearing the inmate's voice for the first time humanized him. Danielle had never heard the man's voice before because he always refused to come to court when she was there. That little moment of shock really put into perspective what was about to happen.
You know, I had talked to other journalists about like the different reactions people had because I kind of wanted to be ready for maybe what his body did. And they were saying it was pretty calm and maybe like a snort or some labored breathing or something. But I remember Brigitte's face just like changing into sudden like shock. And he looked up at the warden and he said, technically his last words were, "Is it supposed to feel like this?" And that made me think, oh, you know, because everyone's like, you know, it's a humane process. It's not painful. They don't feel anything, like something stops their heart. And when he was like, "Is it supposed to feel like this?" I thought, oh, what? I mean, yeah, that also kind of hit me.
The moments between the last breath and the death certification seem to stretch to infinity.
Usually the inmate kind of puffs out their takes some deep breaths and kind of puffs air out of their cheeks. And then usually, you know, maybe there's occasionally a little bit of a, just a tad bit of like a shudder or like a movement. But the thing is, in South Carolina, they don't send in a doctor to check on whether the inmate's dead or not for usually over 10 minutes. And everybody's just kind of sitting there. I mean, you can tell that there's no more movement or anything. And it's that was, if you want to take an unnerving part, that might be the most unnerving part of it. Is usually there's that 10 minute lag between the time they send in the doctor to make sure that the inmate is dead.
It was a little surreal watching somebody actually take their last breath.
But the thing I remember from that execution was his brother was one of the witnesses.
The only one that I still remember to this day was the Coble execution.
One of the guards passed out and fell onto the person that was dying.
I just remember him looking at his dad and saying that he loved him.
I remember Richard Johnson turning his head and his eyes caught his brother, and he kind of smiled at his brother.
Look back at him and say, you know, I love you too, son. And, you know, right before he watched his son die,
they start gasping. This guy actually let out a screech.
Smiled at his brother.
He did not go quietly.
I remember he held up a peace sign as he was saying his last words.
And his brother took his hand and put his fist over his heart a couple of times.
I remember I talked to the victim's wife.
One of the family members started beating on the protective glass in between the witness room and the death chamber.
I remember she was terrified of how people were going to talk about her and her family on social media.
He was basically drug out of the chamber by law enforcement.
And all, you know, his arms were strapped down, so all Johnson could do is just kind of nod at him.
She has a lot of hurt still. She was very open about wanting this man to die. And I remember her telling me, she said, I want to stick up for my husband who died, but also my grandkids are on social media and people say horrible things about me and my family and their grandpa who died.
One of the family members started beating on the protective glass. And
at the execution, when she got up after it happened to say something, she was crying and saying, please remember, I have family on social media.
Look back at him and say, you know, I love you too, son. And, you know, right before he watched his son die, it just struck me as how troubling and disturbing that would be to know that you're going to watch your son die in front of you.
And, you know, his final words were he wished his mother a happy Mother's Day, told kids not to do drugs.
And then it was just done. And I'm like, wow.
Part of the deal is you go in there kind of understanding that you're telling everybody's story in there. Yes, there's a person that's dying in front of you, and that's the person that's the focus of the story. But there's also all these other things that go on that day and all these other medical, emotional, empathetic components that go on with it.
At the end of the day, everybody is human. Hell, even the journalists have to cope with watching a person die in front of them. A study by Koopman and two other authors was done with 18 media witnesses in California. And out of those 18, 60% of them reported feeling detached from other people in the chamber, including their surroundings. There's this unusual dichotomy where the media witness has to simultaneously report all details and be present for that, at least mentally, while detaching themselves emotionally from the situation. And emotional reactions are a human response, especially when a person is dying in front of you. And so it's interesting to me that there's another conflict for journalists. They have to suppress something that's innately human, the emotional response, in order to tell a complete story that humanizes others. An AP journalist based in Oklahoma City named Sean Murphy, whose voice you heard amongst the audio collage, elaborated on the various techniques that journalists use to deal with tragedies like these.
I kind of have to compartmentalize it, you know, it's just a part of my job. So I just, you know, I kind of just focus on the news angle of it and then just kind of try to decompress later. I did, knowing that I was going to speak with you, I did kind of think about like, how do I process these, handling these executions. And usually it's about a 2-hour drive to McAlester from Oklahoma City, where I live. And so I usually call my close friends or family on the way home and just kind of I think process it that way, just by talking through it with people that I'm close to.
This is just a further reminder of how journalists are humans too. Just like the families of the inmate and the victim, reporters have to process what they're witnessing too. Journalists also have to extend empathy to everyone in the room while maintaining their emotional distance. It's paradoxical at times to be in this detached state, away from the somber and gray atmosphere of the execution chamber, but still be able to depict everyone's story in that caring human manner that is sought after in journalism. Even if tragedy glares upon itself in the execution chamber, I'm glad we have reporters in the room to bring those stories to us and do them justice. Thank you to the platform of CC Mixer for providing music by Septa Helix and Rob Walker Poet, and Free Music Archive for providing music by Tech Theist, Bruce Arizabalaga Quintet, EXETEXE, and CRTVTR. We haven't finished our journey yet. On the next episode of Edge of Empathy, I talk to wardens about their duties in supervising executions. I've been your host, Jonathan, and I'll speak to you later.